We got quite a Canada Day game. We've got quite a series going. And Julia, we have a division race going in the American League East. The Toronto Blue Jays win 12-5 against the Yankees. They go up 2-0 so far in this four-game series. We'll do it again at 7 o'clock tonight, at 7 o'clock tomorrow, see how this thing plays out. But as we speak this morning on Jays Talk Plus, the Toronto Blue Jays one game out of the division, and they've passed the Tampa Bay Rays. The Athletics once again doing a job for us in extra innings last night. One game out. How you feeling?
So, sweep? That's how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
That is how I'm feeling. Listen, in the words of a famous Brazilian soccer player, they're allowing us to dream. You beat Carlos Rodon, you beat Max Fried, and you really beat Max Fried, right? It's not that the Blue Jays were biding their time until they got to the bullpen. They actually got to Max Fried. And now you look at the next couple of games in this series. Yes, it's still very much an uphill battle because that Yankees lineup is no joke, as Kevin Gausman will probably tell you. But there's a lot to like about the way that the Blue Jays are playing right now and the fact that they're finding so many different ways, Blake, to get the job done.
I like the way you're thinking. It reminds me very much of the Toronto Raptors championship in 2019, where Nick Nurse tried to rally the team. Let's go to Golden State and take one of two. Let's get one back. Let's get home court advantage back. And Kawhi Leonard allegedly said, F that. Let's get both. And the Raptors famously did that. Nice. So maybe the Toronto Blue Jays are looking at this as, well, you've already got the split. If you win one of these next two, you can take the series. But yeah, you got to be feeling a little sweepy. At least you know Jamie Campbell's got the broom ready for tomorrow
you
on the Blue Jays Central set. It would be no more ridiculous than his and Caleb's outfits from yesterday. Love that tradition.
Me too.
But yeah, what a fun one. And you said it. You just won the Carlos Rodon and Max Fried games. Like, if you were going to line up what a 2-2 series split would look like, you would still hope to take one of those games. You don't want to leave it all on beating Will Warren and Clark Schmidt in the back half. But you certainly wouldn't have been pegging those two as the two that you take. You would have been looking at Will Warren. And Will Warren and Clark Schmidt are good. Will Warren's been one of the least fortunate pitchers in baseball when we look at the underlying stuff. So even a low 4 ZRA probably undersells how good he is, how weird he is. And it must be so – the Blue Jays – no Blue Jay has ever faced him before. It's funky.
Distracting, perhaps.
But you got to feel good about where you're at. You take the two. And yesterday, you mentioned it. They've been doing this in a bunch of different ways. Yesterday, their primary means of doing it was George Springer, who you texted me at one point during the game after he had just one home run.
Right on.
And you were like, am I remembering right? Does George Springer always have good games on Canada Day? And I looked it up and sent you the numbers. And George Springer loves Canada Day. He finished yesterday 3-for-4, a walk, 2 runs, 7 ribbies, and a pair of home runs.
Yeah.
For his Blue Jays career, which now spans 5 Canada Day games, he is 9-for-19 with 3 walks, 3 homers, a stolen base, 5 runs, and 10 RBI.
Yeah, that's he does it for Canada, man. That's kind of it. And he's had a few Canada Day moments before, but this one certainly it just trumps everything else, right? It was just so good. It was an all-around performance. That first home run, it was just a good piece of hitting. You kind of could see that maybe that's a curveball outside, was not exactly what he was expecting. I think that he was very much expecting that location, but maybe not that pitch. Well, he stayed with it. He sent it out of the park, and it's George Springer finding these new gears, finding new ways to beat opponents. And then he adds the RBI single later on. The definition of not trying to do too much and reaping the results for that.
And it's pretty incredible that, you know, each of those instances really fundamentally changed the game. And that's that seems obvious to say, but it changes the game over the course of a four-game series as well. It really changes the accounting of the series. So, you know, when he comes up in the fourth inning and he hits that solo leadoff home run, first of all, that is extremely rare for Max Fried. He's been a reverse splits guy. I talked yesterday about how his cutter development has been death on righties, and he had only given up 2 home runs to right-handed hitters so far this year. He had not given up one with 2 strikes in a count when he gets ahead in a count, other than one garbage time one when they were like, I don't know if he was that locked in. And so George Springer does that. He gets a curveball midway. It's good too. You can go back and, you know, I love doing this and kind of like reverse engineering how the plate appearance happened based on what was going on earlier. He had swung and a miss at a sweeper and a changeup in the zone. So he clearly was geared up, and then he fouled off a fastball in. So whether that was geared up for the fastball and adjusting to the other stuff, but by the time that curveball came, he was ready. And that starts a 4-run rally. they have a big inning. In the seventh, it's even more important when he hits that grand slam. Four runs on the board is huge regardless. But at that point, they're up 5-4. And you don't have Jeff Hoffman. You don't think you have Brendan Little. You're talking about, like, is Mason Flew already going to have to pitch a second game in a row in leverage? And, like, you really don't like the way your bullpen decision tree is looking against that tough, tough Yankees order. And then,
boom.
Five-run lead.
Yeah. It's that is – I know that I've been talking about this a lot. But when a team has that many ways in which they can beat you, every way is important. There is nothing quite like hitting a home run with runners on, putting the game out of reach, giving yourself some flexibility. And on the bullpen, I think we expected Yariel Rodriguez to get the ninth regardless, just mm-hmm. because of where the bullpen
was. Well, there's nobody
was.
Else available, basically.
Yeah, but allowing him to pitch one inning instead of two, bringing in Chad Green with a cushion, with a little bit of a margin, and being able to sort of breathe a little bit, that was huge, because this is a four-game series, and you look at the schedule, the Blue Jays are still ways away from their next off day. So every single move matters. They needed all of the guys who were available still, because Kevin Gausman labored through five innings there. But what a way to do it on Canada Day.
Yeah, and then there's one other element too, where even the cherry on top in the eighth inning, him scoring those runs didn't fundamentally change how you're going to use your bullpen, right, or what the final score looked like. Did cause the Yankees to use one extra reliever.
That's right.
They had someone in there who was just, you know, clean this up. Can you heart leap? Can you just finish this thing out and save us? And he couldn't. So they had to go to an extra arm. And maybe that doesn't really matter for these ones because, you know, Hartlieb and Brubaker are not the highest leverage guys, but you still made them use an extra guy. It still changes what the bullpen red, green, yellow looks like into today. And I want to say, too, on that grand slam, I know I did the reverse engineering for the other home run, but he had chased a changeup low early in that plate appearance and then saw it again and laid off of it. So Weaver goes to a fastball and said, Springer has signaled, I chased one, I'm not chasing another one. Mm-hmm. That was in an even better spot, and I'm not offering at it. You got to come inside the zone, and then Weaver comes inside the zone. And
too much.
Yeah.
Way too much.
Way too much. Yes, I'm not saying it was a good pitch, but good on Springer. You chase the first one, and it's a bad chase, and then you reestablish quickly. They're like, okay, throw it again. I'm not. I learned my lesson.
Yeah.
You better come inside the zone.
It was something else to also see just Luke Weaver throw everything down, not just to Springer, but also to Ernie Clement, who had an RBI single before Springer hit the grand slam there. It was so clear that was, you know, part of the game plan, and you could look sort of in that half of the zone and try to do something. But then when you leave a fastball like that middle with the way that George Springer is hitting right now, and, you know, just the renewed impetus to get the A swing out once every at bat and things like that, well, If you see a middle fastball, I'll tell you, that's the perfect time to get your A swing off, and that's exactly what that was. It was a no doubter.
Especially if already in that plate appearance you've ruled out the changeup because you chased the bad one, you know, and you can lock in a little bit more. Couple George Springer stats for you. So the Canada Day stats were obviously fun. Here's another one.
Yep.
Over the last 5 weeks, he has 29 RBI in 28 games. Only Cal Raleigh and Max Muncy, LA, not Max Muncy Athletics.
Oh, thank you.
Only those two players have more runs batted in over the last 5 weeks than George Springer. On the season, he's now back up to an 854 OPS. That is a 140 WRC plus, so about 40% better than a league average bat. I went and I looked. So George Springer is 35 years old. Mm-hmm. Among players who are 34 and older, and I chose this cutoff because Aaron Judge is 33 and I didn't want him included.
Nice.
So 34 and older. There are just not a lot of 34 and older guys playing regularly in the majors anymore. There are only 33 players who have had 100 plate appearances this year and are 34 and older. Only Freddie Freeman is hitting better than George Springer.
Yeah, I believe you. I mean,
I hope so. I looked the numbers up this morning.
It's just, like Freddie Freeman is going to be Freddie Freeman as long as he's playing. But just a continuation. And again, George Springer will talk to Hazel May postgame and he'll talk to other reporters postgame. And the one thing that he keeps coming back on is the coaching staff, is David Popkins and company, and the fact that they have helped him unlock something in his swing. And you can see the mechanics of those swings. he's a guy that's in control right now. You know, his body is moving the way that it's supposed to, and he is able to just focus on what it is that he is trying to do. He knows his role. He knows what he's here for, and he's accepted that. And that's pretty cool. It's just, so Sho and I did pre and post game over the weekend, and on Sunday, Sho asked me, hey, have you asked George Springer about, you know, whether or not his mentality has changed now that he is out of the leadoff spot? Because basically that's what he'd been doing for most of his career. And I said, okay, I'll ask him for you, right? And I did. And it was cool to hear Springer say that it doesn't really change in that regard, but he understands that his role for this team has changed, not necessarily in the lineup, but just who he is in the clubhouse, on the roster, and also in the lineup and on defense, et cetera. He said that is where the adjustment actually came mentally for him. And, well, it's working out. And if he still has these protagonist moments like he did yesterday, then the Blue Jays only have to gain for it, especially, Blake, on a day when they didn't get a whole lot out of the rest of the top of that lineup.
Ironically, this would be the best he would have performed in the leadoff position so far as a Blue Jay. This is the highest on base rate that he's had and the highest walk rate he's had as a Blue Jay. So yeah. Not that that's everything in the leadoff spot, but it is like at least a little amusing to me that he slides down and then gets back to being like a more leadoff type guy. He also leads the team in home runs, so not going to argue with him being in the middle of the order. And up to 47 RBI in the season, almost on pace for a hundy,
yeah,
which is pretty rare in general these days, but it's been fairly rare for the Blue Jays. And Bo Bichette's off the pace now that he's missed a couple games. So yeah, it's that's always interesting to hear how that dynamic changes. The other thing George Springer is always trying to do, and his gimmick got stolen last night.
Okay.
Catcher's interference played a big role in the game once again. This time it was, yep, Addison Barger. He struck out, but it was catcher's interference to load the bases. That set the stage for Ernie Clement to have an RBI single and then George Springer to hit the grand slam. He probably went up there. If I'm committed to the bit of I have twice as many catcher's interferences as anyone else, I'm going up and I'm ready. I'm like, bases loaded. I'm getting catcher's interference here. And then Addison Barger does it. And it's like, well, I got to do something else now. So yeah. I guess I'll hit a grand slam.
That's such a good point. Like, well, okay, you stole my thing. I guess, yeah, I'm going to go and do something.
It's like if we came on and you started the show with like a bunch of analytics, that like really deep analytics stuff. I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do now.
Well, sure. I guess I can just, yeah, chime in with work every once in a while. Yeah. And the reverse roles a little bit. So Springer, yeah, went ahead and stole Barger's thing, I guess, which is hitting for power against a righty, no less. So, yeah, pretty good. I think, I don't know if you went on Twitter or the socials afterwards and took a peek at how Yankees fans are feeling right now, but it was one of those things where I felt so, again, I understood how spoiled we are with the Blue Jays by reading Yankees fans' comments where it's just hammering the team for not executing the fundamentals, obviously the catcher's interference included.
Yes. Now, this comes with the caveat that, as we talked about a little bit with Keith McPherson the other day, Yankees fans have, there is a level of entitlement and Yankees exceptionalism where they entered this series in first place with the best run differential in the league. They had just won 6 of 10 after that short losing streak. And you would think from our conversation with Keith or Keith's mentions or looking at Yankee fans on Twitter that the Yankees were in last place and everything had spiraled out of control. So they are obvious. They were always going to overreact. The expectation for that franchise is so like high. Championship, yeah, every year and 162-0, which this is not, I'm not saying this negatively about them. It would be great if the Blue Jays were eventually in a position where the expectation is perfection, mm-hmm, and Anthony Volpe can be a teenager with a league average batting line at a premium defensive position and everyone would be really mad at him all the time. Like that's a good problem to have. I will say the left side of that Yankees infield, not covering themselves in glory. As for if I'm aware of Yankees Twitter, a little bit, because I like Keith a lot and I follow him and I see some stuff via that. There's obviously Blue Jays fans who will sometimes like tongue in cheek retweet Yankees people to like have fun with it.
Right.
But the biggest one is actor Nick Turturro.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Nick Turturro?
Yes.
John Turturro's brother.
Yeah.
Nick Turturro of, he was in The Longest Yard.
And John Turturro is from Severance, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Okay. And a million other things. Yes. John Turturro is one of the best to ever do it. Nick Turturro is his brother, and he's a bit typecast. He was in Do the Right Thing, but, you know, people more recently probably know him for The Longest Yard and kind of like comedy bits like that. He spends entire Yankees games just filming himself and posting his overreactions to stuff. Him melting down yesterday, like post after post after post about George Springer in that game. That is what I was consuming. Oh. And it makes me think, there are Blue Jays fans who are smart. There are Blue Jays fans who are entertaining. There are Blue Jays fans who are negative all the time. I don't think in the space we have a charismatic crazy fan. Mm-hmm. Like the people who are charismatic or whatever are having fun with it. I don't think we have a Nick Turturro of like, this guy is so negative, but also the performance is really good.
And the market is right there. I mean, this is a team that lends itself very well to that sort of interaction with fans. So yeah, if you're listening to this and you're kind of funny, maybe start recording yourself and posting it on the internet.
The tough thing too is like, you can't fake it though. Like,
you cannot fake
like
it.
Nick Turturro is the performance is good, I think, because he is a career actor.
Yes.
He has a level of ability to perform. He doesn't mind being the butt of the joke when he's overreacting and stuff like that. I don't know that you could just be like, I'm going to be that.
I'm going to do this.
Now, I don't think
you
could do it.
Because maybe you do need already a built-in audience that to work.
Yeah, and it just might not seem genuine.
Yeah.
All the celeb Blue Jays fans are, like, nice.
I'm trying to think.
Like, chill.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who could fill
that
role.
Like, Geddy Lee's not doing that. And
no.
Geddy Lee's going to come up in the show a little later because we got Bob Kendrick on the show. By the way, Lindsey Dunn and Whit Merrifield are going to join us in the next segment. Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro League Baseball Museum, will join us around 11 o'clock. We talk, among other things, Dave Parker, the Cobra, who passed away last week and finished his career with the Toronto Blue Jays. We talk a lot about, by the way, some of the connections between Canada and the Negro Leagues Museum, including people like Cito Gaston, who are in there, but also Canada's role in the Negro Leagues at their height when they were a barnstorming league and would often come to Canada to play professional teams like the Montreal Black Panthers, nice. The shirt that I'm wearing today. We'll also talk to Levi Weaver. We'll talk about the Texas Rangers and we'll go around some of the rest of the baseball playoff races. But now that I'm finished talking about Nick Turturro and wanting to get him on the show.
No, that was awesome.
He couldn't go on the show. I think Nick Blackmore, our producer this week, he would get like a finger injury from the sensor button.
Yep.
If he's
I can
the
see
one
that.
Hitting it. Maybe it's Austin Mackey who has to hit it. Either way.
Yeah. Listen, there's two games left in this series. There's plenty of time to overreact one side or another. And I don't know. Who knows? They're allowing us to dream here. Maybe we'll get Nick Turturro as well.
Yeah, you're going back to that. They're allowing us to dream. If they win today, that's the headline on the show tomorrow again. Okay, a couple other quick notes on this one. The Jays scored 12 runs on only 8 hits.
Yeah,
that is only the third time that's happened in Major League Baseball since the Blue Jays did it back in 1999. To do that, you have to get 6 walks. You have to go 5-for-7 with runners in scoring position. And to your earlier point, you got to hit homers with runners on base because you got to make sure every one of those hits comes around to score. There was also, you know, we've talked a couple times this series already about the versatility of different ways to get the job done. Different guys contributing. You know, in the first game of the series, it was a lot of the bottom of the order guys getting it done and then just keeping it rolling enough for Vlad to come up in a big spot. Yesterday, no Bo Bichette in the lineup. Alejandro Kirk, 0-for. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., 0-for. So your top 4 guys, because I think Springer's been like this long enough that we can consider that a top 4. You got 0 out of 3 of them, and you were still able to put up a big number like that. Still no Dom Varsho or Anthony Santander, obviously. That level of it is awesome. And then, to win a game with the long ball, 3 homers that produce 7 runs. Andrés Giménez is just
It
just like hung there. I didn't think it was out off the bat. It just kind of like stayed up and stayed up. I guess Springer's first one was kind of like that too.
It was kind of like that, yeah.
Maybe some wind scoops with the dome open. I don't know.
That pair of homers is something that I did while we were, you know, while the game was happening. It was like, if the roof had stayed closed.
And I don't know. Like, we don't know especially with the new dimensions. I've talked about this before, right? Like, you need, in a normal environment, you need 3 years for park factors to, like, stabilize. But the Blue Jays have changed their dimensions multiple years in a row when it comes to foul space and crowd structure. And even things like where the seats are situated does affect the airflow and stuff like that. So they keep changing it. Half the games are with the dome closed. Half the games are with the dome open. There's also, like, I would bet even when the dome's open, there are different weather effects around the lake effects and things like that. So I don't know, but it's certainly both of those home runs reminded me of, actually they looked a lot, they reminded me a lot of, so Kevin Gausman struck Giancarlo Stanton out on 296-mile-an-hour fastballs that were right in the zone. They were challenge fastballs that Giancarlo Stanton swung under. Mm-hmm. And they were both, when we talk about a fastball that has late rise or late carry or something like that, you just kept waiting for it to drop.
Yep.
And like, obviously the fastball rising is an optical illusion. It doesn't actually go up, but that it doesn't drop nearly as much as you expect, and it just kind of hangs there. It fooled Giancarlo Stanton twice. That's exactly what both of those homers look like to me, where I just like kept waiting for them to go down. And I don't know if they just
That's
had like
point.
it was backspin on them or what, but they just kind of stayed up and just hung just enough.
Yeah, good for the Blue Jays. I mean, not all of them need to be no doubters, right? You can run into a little bit of luck as well. And I go back to something that Max Scherzer said while he was still rehabbing and, you know, joined the broadcast and said, yeah, sometimes you have to create your own luck. That is what the Blue Jays did. And they did so by swinging at the right pitches, by letting the not right pitches go and taking their walks and loading the bases. And, you know, just a bunch of the stuff that we've spoken about, that is what makes this offense dangerous and really, you know, worth respecting. That was all on display again. And then when you get those home runs,
yes,
with runners on, it really just tie it all together.
That's the thing. The like create your own luck or got to be good to be lucky effects are like, okay, that's how you get a guy on. That's
right.
How you get Miles Straw advances an extra base on because Volpe goes too deep into the hole and throws a ball that he had no chance to get. That's those are the kind of little things. And then, yeah, the can you take advantage of it? Can
exactly.
you create a little bit of, not create your own luck, but like it's one thing if you get like, okay, here's pocket aces. You still got to play the hand.
Right on.
And that's where a home run with two on, a grand slam comes through. Andrés Giménez, this is a low bar, but the OPS is back up over 600 now. Six hits in his last four starts. So
yeah.
Small signs of life there.
Very curious to sort of keep monitoring that because, again, I think that maybe Giménez is in a bit of an earlier stage of what we saw from the Blue Jays offense collectively earlier this season, where there were signs and there were underlying numbers, but then, you know, he's striking out a lot or whatever. And now that he's picking it back up, I'm just curious if he can maintain that. Maybe we will see a similar story, but just, you know, he got injured, he wasn't around and all of that.
And there's still some underlying stuff. Like it doesn't say Andrés Giménez, like when you look under the hood, it certainly doesn't say Andrés Giménez is going to win a Silver Slugger,
mm-hmm.
but it says Andrés Giménez could find his way back to being like almost a league average hitter.
Right.
And then like with the defense, you're okay with that.
You're pretty fine with it.
But yeah, I mean, this is saying his OPS is back north of the Ordóñez line at 600 is that's a low bar. So, okay. Wanted to touch on Kevin Gausman quick before we take a break and talk to Lindsey Dunn and Whit Merrifield. He goes five innings, dances through trouble in four of them. So first inning, two runs score, but he manages to strand two. Third, fourth, and fifth inning, he strands two runners in each of those. With two outs, he gets Anthony Volpe twice. He gets Jason Dominguez twice. He strikes Giancarlo Stanton out twice with two men on with that same fastball in that same spot. He also gets a Cody Bellinger out there. So seven outs with two runners on across the third, fourth, and fifth inning there. The Stanton strikeouts were nasty. He obviously, Kevin Gausman was not at his very best.
Mm-hmm.
The Yankees were getting a lot of traffic on. Aaron Judge was obviously a difficult matchup, and the pitch efficiency wasn't there to go beyond five. But what a battle from Kevin Gausman.
Oh, yeah. And that's a good pitcher on the mound, right? I was curious to hear from you because the eye test tells me, okay, this is not the crispest outing, if that makes sense. Like, it's obviously good stuff. Again, he skirted away from trouble, and the top of the Yankees lineup is extremely dangerous. Aaron Judge was on base every single time, whether that was intentional walks or not. And it is always going to be a battle. That is a very dangerous lineup. But, and then you add to that he was walking a ton of guys. And maybe the strike zone was a little iffy on both sides, right? It's it looks like a moving strike zone a little bit. And that also obviously contributes to the walks there, but it's been a problem, right? We got a little bit of reprieve from that in his past outing, but it's right back. So still worth monitoring, but the fact that he's making the big pitches, Blake, I think you're pretty happy with that. Obviously, Blue Jays would have loved to see Gausman go six at least, and maybe the bullpen is in a bit of a different situation here, but with Jimmy Garcia set to return in the coming days.
Yeah, was that the sense pregame? Like, I know they didn't announce that he's going back to Buffalo to throw anymore.
No. Based on what Ross Atkins said, based on what John Schneider said, it was more just figuring out when to activate him. And if something changes, then something changes. That's beyond our control. But yeah, the sense that we got is it was just a matter of time now until he was activated.
That could be the case for Ryan Burr too. So Justin Brule and or Mason Fluharty. Good seeing you while we saw you there. Okay. Leo Jimenez was up yesterday, by the way. He got the start and then got pinch hit for. That is partially Jonathan Clase has been shaky. We talked about that. He's going to go back down and try to get regular at-bats, regular reps in the outfield at the AAA level. This gives him a little bit of coverage with Bo Bichette missing the last two games with right knee discomfort. It sounded like Bo was potentially even available off the bench yesterday. Mm-hmm. That obviously didn't come up. So maybe you see him back in the lineup today. We talked about Max Scherzer yesterday coming out of that game at 71 pitches and feeling fatigued. The word yesterday was that he was feeling about the same as last start. So this is start-to-start monitoring. Doesn't sound like there's any real concern. Obviously, he will throw a bullpen today or tomorrow, depending on how they're lining up the weekend. And yeah, seems like that's A-OK, but the fatigue element there is something they're going to have to continue to keep an eye on. Let's take a break.
Okay.
Lindsay Dunn is waiting at the door, and I need to go let her in. So I will go do that. We will also talk to Whit Merrifield. They have a new podcast that launched today. Whit announced his retirement recently, so we'll chop it up with them. We'll get to know about this podcast a little bit. We'll talk to Whit Merrifield about, he said on the first episode of their podcast, actually, that in 2023, that room that he was a part of at one point in the season thought they were going to win the World Series. Mm-hmm. Didn't play out that way. He's been around the Blue Jays the last little bit. Let's see if he thinks anything different about this team, if they feel a little different to him. That's next. Second hour, we'll talk to Bob Kendrick and Levi Weaver as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. And also with us is Lindsay Dunn. That sounded like at church when they say peace be with you and also with you. Like, and also with us, Lindsay Dunn of City News TO of the new Sixth Inning Stretch podcast. Lindsay, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys.
You're going to unknowingly be part of a quick mailbag segment while we wait for Whit Merrifield to, your new co-host, to figure out how to turn a camera on Zoom.
Typical Whit.
We are, so there is a regular texter who likes to text the show and only complain about Mitch Marner. And so Flounder in Cambridge just texted in and said, "You are now free to speak Blue Jays. He's gone," with several exclamation points. So just wanted to get that one in because it's been a running bit on the show for like three seasons now. How are you feeling about the end of the Mitch Marner? I know you do a little Leaf stuff too.
Yeah, so either people know me for Jays or Raptors, and then the odd Leafs thing. I have such a different relationship with the players because I don't usually have to ask any tough questions. So Mitch was always good to me in the locker room. I went to his charity events. I went golfing with him when he had a mental health initiative when he was raising money for it. So it's like, man, did he get grilled by the media, though? There was such a hate for him and some of the fans that I've never experienced it. But for me, like, he was nice to me. And yesterday I was speaking to a lot of fans at the Jays game about this. They're like, he never showed up in the playoffs. I was like, yo, wasn't just him, but he also had some pretty good games. The bad thing is, like, I'm indifferent to it. I don't know if that means anything. It's because we cover the teams. I'm like, please win a Stanley Cup while I have a job. I would love that.
That'd be great. It's tough too. He's like because the criticism stuff of him is it's the most like, well, that's what the money's for. That's why you're the highest paid. That's why you make Chris Boucher money as a top paid guy in the NBA. It's a little bit of a tough one. It's funny to text with friends about and stuff like that. Actually, I saw Mitch in an outlandish hat at the City and Color after hang. The other week, just an outlandish hat. Would make Carmelo Anthony and The Undertaker be like, that's a big hat, bro.
Can you describe it for us?
It's just like, I don't know. It's one of those.
It's almost like a Mountie hat.
Yeah, like one of those like fashion-y, like big wide brim hat. I don't know how to describe it to people other than it's The Undertaker hat or the Carmelo Anthony hat if you're a wrestling or basketball fan. Do we have Whit? No one has let me know what the status of Whit is.
I hope he's listening because Whit.
Yeah, so Lindsay, let me give you actually a follow up about what you said on, you know, maybe not being there to ask the hardest hitting questions, which is, it is a different job. And I'm wondering, first of all, how you enjoy it. And if there are challenges to being more of the feature person, you know, maybe when the team is not going as well, or things along those lines, how do you sort of navigate that?
Oh, I love watching athletes run away from me if it's like they're not having a good stretch. But like the odd time, like I will have to ask an actual question, and I'm like, hey, just so you know, I'm going to do my job and ask you an actual question about your performance. Mm-hmm. So please don't yell at me, but also yell at me because this is my job. But it's fun. I realize like I get so much hate mail, which I love. So keep it coming, because I do a feature story or it's lighthearted. I'll always get, this is why women can't cover sports, which I got yesterday so many times because I spoke about Marner and I said, yeah, he may not have lived up to the expectations he set on himself as well as fans set on himself. But what he did in the community, like you can't let that just slide, because a lot of athletes, when you look at, like, there's a handful of Toronto athletes on teams that actually give back to the community, mm-hmm. and he was one of them. So you can hate him for everything else, but you can't hate him for that. But immediately they're like, this is why women can't cover sports. Mm-hmm. I'm like, fight me. That's the nicest, most polite thing I'm going to say.
Yeah, the person who sent that to you also struggles with walking and chewing gum at the same time. That's you can't
That's
hold
it.
Two thoughts in your head, can't do two things.
That's it.
Okay. I don't know how to transition out of that to, we have Whit Merrifield on the line, your new co-host at the Sixth Inning Stretch, a Blue Jays and baseball podcast at the Nation's Network. 9-year Major League veteran, 3-time All-Star, Whit Merrifield joins us now. Whit, good morning, man. How you doing?
Boo. I'm the one that sent Lindsay that mail.
It was. Look at you learning how to use a camera. Congratulations, buddy.
Look, I don't know what the deal is, but the equipment that you sent me for some reason won't turn on. It's twice now in Zoom. It just won't turn on. But, you know, because I'm tech savvy, I figured it out.
Okay, wait, I got to ask, before we get into the new podcast stuff, you have a good setup behind you, a number of jerseys. I see the Bryce Harper one frame there. Are those the ones hanging behind you? Are those all your jerseys, or are those just ones you've collected from like teammates and fandom over the years?
No, so this is what I call my locker. So I got, like, in the side, I got my dad's college jerseys, and then I have like my 11-year-old travel ball jerseys, to middle school football, to high school, to some college jerseys. I think I even have one or two minor league jerseys, and then Kansas City, Toronto, Philly, and Atlanta. So that's my locker. I've got some hats up top, but the camera's tilted down so you can't see it, and then cleats in the bottom. I got bats right here, gloves. So
that's a cool setup.
Cool little, yeah.
It's all right. It is a pretty cool setup. And Whit, obviously, you know, we remember you well from your time in Toronto. The fans remember you well. Also, we are wondering, if both of you actually, you know, if you could tell us a little bit about just how this podcast idea started. Why you kind of chose to work with each other.
That's my main question. Why Lindsay?
I'm gonna take this, and then you guys can talk to Whit for the next 20 minutes. People don't know that Whit and I have been best friends for 14 minutes. It's been amazing. I cover sports in Toronto, and Whit, earmuffs, I actually don't want you to listen to this. When I interviewed him the first couple times he was here, he was so funny that right after, my camera guys were like, this guy's hilarious. And we would constantly get viewer emails saying how, like, it was complete chaos, which is just how this podcast happened. And I distinctly remember the second time I ever interviewed Whit. It was a Boba Shett bundle giveaway where they had, like, the bandana and then a jersey. And because I, like, don't care what people think, I put the bandana on during the interview, but Whit put the jersey on. And then I made, like, an offhanded comment, like, ooh, I don't know if I'm interviewing Whit or Bo. He did the interview as if he was Bo Bichette, and it was the funniest thing and so unexpected. And that's how kind of like the podcast is just a bunch of chaos. And it was funny because I actually haven't had the chance to speak to Whit about this, but over the last couple of days, people at the ballpark were like, hey, we're so excited for this. When is the debut episode happening?
Today, by the way.
Today, Six Inning Stretch, find it anywhere. And they're like, also, can you help me meet Whit? I'm like, oh, really, I'm doing this because I want the world to know what he's really like. Like, we have in his contract, anytime we have a joint appearance, I have to wear a shirt with his face on it. So I got this shirt off of eBay, Whit, and I actually think I might have got hosed because there's a signature on it. They said it was authentic, but I'm pretty sure, like, that it's not. So I'm going to be billing you for this, buddy.
You were holding that up in the worst possible. No one could see the signature on that.
Just know that it's fake, I guess.
It's fake. I'm pretty sure it's fake. Sure, very much real. But yeah.
All right, Whit, for your side of it, I know you talked about the retirement a little bit on Foul Territory last week. You guys get into it on the first episode of Six Inning Stretch, which is out on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts today. Can you take us through a little bit your decision to call it a career and why, you know, going into podcasting with Lindsay was the next step for you?
Well, podcasting with Lindsay wasn't exactly the plan, but the call came and, you know, I liked the opportunity and thought it was it'd be a fun deal. And so, yeah, me and Lindsay have been best friends ever since. But the retirement situation was just a culmination of things. I get more into it in the podcast, but the main reason, my daughter being born in March of last year, spending the year away from her, not enjoying that, was a big reason. Aside from that, it took my focus away from me playing and what I needed to do to play at a high level. Found out quickly that I can't play at a high level and not have my focus totally on the game. So it was an easy way for me to transition out. That's why we're here now. And they called me for this podcast because they needed a name. They asked Lindsay for a name for the podcast, and she obviously couldn't come up with anything smart because she's not as clever as I am. So I came up with Six Inning Stretch, and that was the only idea I had because it was just right off the top of the head, and they liked it way more than anything she thought of. So here we are. And
it's true.
It's a good opportunity podcast. Because my whole thing playing, the thing I miss the most is the constant back and forth banter, the trash talking, the sarcasm that comes with being in a locker room every day. And this is a way for me to continue to do that. And instead of channeling it towards 25 dudes in a locker room, I get to take all that energy and channel it towards this blonde chick I'm going to be sharing the mic with.
I love this because I hate being nice to you. It's hilarious. And his sarcasm is so good because on the podcast, like the first time I saw Whit in person was when we filmed this. The last time I saw him was before the team went and lost to the Twins in a little postseason action. And it was just like constantly riffing on me. And half the time, like, I can't tell if you're serious or not because this is hilarious. And it's just like the text constantly, like, I have no idea what you're saying, but this is gold.
It's good content.
It is a great content. So he's made for being a podcast king.
What can you do?
But when he called, like, when we announced the podcast about a week ago, he's like, this chick, like, try to dab me up and look cool about it. And, like, for people that don't know him, he's just being funny. But yep. A couple people are like, can you believe he called you chick? I'm like, yeah. And he's a dude. What's up with that?
Yeah. Bro.
So he's been canceled before episode one.
Yeah, I've been, my sarcasm doesn't quite come through as much as I would like for it to on text or Twitter or anything like that. So I got to be a little more careful with that. But yeah, I would say 95% of the things that I say are not serious. So I should just probably put that disclaimer out there right now.
People learn, though. This is the nice thing about a regular show, too, yeah. Right? Is yeah. People pick that up and they're like, oh, that's just Whit. So look, 95% is overstating it. I listened to the first episode.
You're understating it.
but one of the things that is clear that you want to do through this, and whether it's, you know, big chunks of episodes or just here and there, but you kind of said you want to pull the curtain back a little bit and show fans and listeners and things like that, what is it actually like? Because I can sit here and talk about how I analyze it. Julia can sit here and I saw this in the locker room or I asked this guy. But you've lived it. What is that aspect of it going to mean to you? Being able to tell fans, you know, hey, this is what it's actually like. This is what it was like when I was there a year ago, 2 years ago. This is how the game actually works.
Yeah, I think being so fresh out of it is a good time, you know, to kind of talk about this because I'm not so far removed from the game that I sort of forget how the game moves and works. And one of the biggest sayings is the further you get from the game, the easier the game becomes, and the more you forget how hard the game actually is. So I think it's important for people that are knowledgeable of the game, that have been in the game, that have been in between the lines and dealt with the things that these players are dealing with now over 162 game season, to be able to elaborate on like what they're going through, what's actually happening. Yeah, that game looked bad or that play looked bad, but it really wasn't as bad as you think because of X, Y, and Z. I think the Blue Jays in particular for me, I'm still really good friends with a lot of the guys on the team. I play with a lot of guys on the team. So I know their personality. I know how they are. So I think there's a little bit of insight that I can bring with that. And without, you know, trashing the guys too much, because I don't want Dalton showing up at my house. But I mean, I don't know if you guys remember a couple weeks ago when George, you know, rolled his ankle rounding second and hopped up and down on third base and got tagged out. Like, that was a great funny moment. And just, you know, George blaming his ankle for making a dumb mistake. And it's just stuff like that you miss. And it's a lighthearted thing. And so, yeah, hopefully I can, without getting in too much trouble, kind of tell you guys what's going on.
Wait, you mentioned that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I want Dalton to show up at your house. That would be a great episode. I'm inviting
myself. Make sure to
film
it. Yeah,
we will.
Is that
Dalton's a good wrestler? But I got too many guns over here for Dalton to show up.
that makes sense. Dalton would be a good wrestler. The low center of gravity and the football toughness and everything.
Yeah,
we'll just leave the gun part alone for
now. I didn't hear it.
I will say this. Yeah, I'm really happy that when I joined this show, Blake, we already had a name in place. I feel like that really removes
a lot of
the drama there. No problem. But wait, you mentioned the word transitioning, right? Finish your playing career, and now you are very much in transition. When you first got to Toronto, that was also a pretty big transition moment. At least that's what it looked like for us. Kind of felt like it jump-started a new point in your career. How do you remember just your arrival here and the time that you spent with the Blue Jays?
Well, I remember, you know, going from a non-playoff contending team to a playoff contending team. I loved Kansas City. I wanted to be in Kansas City my whole career. And when my contract was winding down over there and it became clear that the club wasn't interested in extending that contract and making me a Royal for the rest of my career, we had some good conversations about moving on and going to a team that has a chance to be in the playoffs. And ultimately what I wanted. And I was sad I couldn't make that happen in Kansas City, but the door opened in Toronto. I remember showing up. I mean, Toronto's always one of the top three places any player wants to go and play as a visitor. And I was excited to experience that being Toronto as my home team. Justin Smoke, who'd played there forever, was my college roommate, and we were still tight. And asking him what it was like, and Ryan Goins, who I played with in Kansas City, who just couldn't say enough good things about Toronto. I'd had this impression of it. And so when I was traded there, I was excited to, one, be on a team that was going to contend to be in the playoffs, and two, be in a big market. I was excited to see what that side of the game was like. Kansas City was a smaller market. And so Toronto is, for Americans, we don't quite grasp how big the Blue Jays are for the country of Canada. I mean, when we would go to Minnesota, when we go to Pittsburgh, when we go to especially Seattle, like, there's blue everywhere because the Canadians from that part of the country would come down and watch us play. And you don't realize that at the time when you're not playing for the Blue Jays. So that was just an incredible experience. And then getting to go to the playoffs twice in Toronto, and once being at home and seeing what the Rogers Center was like for a playoff game is just something that I'll always take with me. And that's why Toronto will always have such a special place for me in my heart.
So you joined those 2022 and 2023 teams that, like you said, made a playoff run. You tell a great story on the first episode of the podcast about how there was a point during that 2023 season where you guys thought you were going to win the World Series, and the vibes were good, the camaraderie was good, the team was playing well. That obviously didn't happen, maybe didn't peak at the right time. When you look at where this Blue Jays team is at, and we're getting you at a good time, they just took two off the Yankees, they're only one game back of the division. What kind of things are you looking for now that you're not in the locker room, or I know you were the other week, but generally, what kind of things are you looking for from the outside to say this team has it, this team's a little different than maybe those other playoff years?
Well, that's the thing, right? With being in the front office is when the trade deadline comes, everybody wants to go and make the biggest splash in the trade market and bring in the guys that are going to help you take you over the top. But baseball is such a unique sport in the way that the camaraderie that you have within the clubhouse is I would say almost more important than any other sport. At least, well, I mean, I haven't played the other sports at a high level, but it's so important to not ruin the dynamic that you have when you, when something's going good. So there's a fine line to walk as to who you're going to bring in to help this team get over the edge, when they're, especially when they're playing good, they're gelling, guys are having a good time, guys are playing hard. And I think that's what the Blue Jays have right now. Yeah, there's a piece or two they can bring in, but you got to bring in the right pieces, guys that are going to come in and fit right in, mold, and not kind of disrupt the good thing that you have going on. So that's kind of what I look at, and I'll look to see, because I would say fans can see it too, but you can see when a team is gelling and playing well and enjoying showing up to the field and playing with each other. Because over 162, it can get grueling. It can get exhausting mentally and physically. And I guess sometimes you get to the point where you almost dread going to the field. I don't see that with this team, and that's a good thing to have. It is only July 2nd, so that's the dog days are coming up. So I'm interested to see what this team looks like come end of October, early September. If they kind of have the same energy and vibe going that they do right now, I wouldn't want to face this team late September, early October into the playoffs. They're going to be a dangerous team. And so it'll be fun to watch. It's baseball's all about clicking at the right time. And so these guys will just – there's no, like, formula to do that, but hopefully they can all start getting hot at the right time.
Yeah, wait, great answer. I'll be honest, I wasn't listening for half of it because, bro, next week we have a big guest and I'm looking at your face and you look like Phantom of the Opera. So you're going to need to fix that lighting a little bit.
The camera was too zoomed out. So the light was like in the picture. So I had to move it over here. Look,
if you're going to be
I'm doing what I can do here.
And I also love, because first episode, I looked at him and was like, I think this is the first time I've seen you without a backwards hat on. And here we go again, bringing it back. This means you need a haircut.
Well, that sets me up.
A haircut or a shower, one of the two.
Try both.
That sets me up quite nicely for my segue, actually, which is... I am wondering, you know, you mentioned a big guest. Yeah, no. a big guest in the next episode. I'm wondering if you guys could answer kind of like separately, what is it that you're most looking forward to with the podcast, with working with each other? What is it that excites you about the future here?
Well, for me, even in the first episode, I'm a Jays fan. I know as sports reporters, like, we're supposed to not be biased, but I'm from Canada. It's the only team. And there's so many. Don't shame me.
I'm not like, shaming you. Like, I roll my eyes at the idea that, like, you can't, like, obviously I can't sit here and, like, cheer, and I'm not cheering in the press box, but who gets into this line of work if you're not a massive fan in the first place?
Yeah. So I love the Jays, and the first episode alone was sharing so many stories that I didn't know about the team, or like how close they actually felt they were in 2023, because I believe they were going to go there. Or there was a story about Kikuchi that when he told it, I was almost in tears. There was all these behind the scenes stories that I love knowing as like a nerd that covers sports. So I'm excited for that. And then people besides me making fun of Wit, like that is what I'm going to look forward to every week. And then Wit also roasting me in a new fashion. And Wit's just happy to work with me. Let's be real. New best friend.
Oh, he's thinking this. Yeah. He's thinking this one through carefully.
No, I mean, I'm excited to stay. This is I've been looking for, I don't know if a reason's the right word, but some motivation to kind of stay focused in the game and pay attention to the game. So this is a good way for me to do that, and especially for the Blue Jays and keep a track of those guys and watching some of these games now and a little more closely. So looking forward to that. Looking forward to talking to old friends, telling stories, just kind of, doing what we would do in the locker room, just with the camera now, maybe, you know, tone it down a little bit for the camera, but it's going to be fun to still be able to have some of those conversations. And it's what you remember as a former player. You don't remember a lot of the actual games or the plays or whatever. You remember the stories of what happened with the guys and the conversations in the locker room. And so being able to kind of continue that just on a different platform is going to be fun for me.
All right. I got to selfishly ask one before we let you go. Wit, when you were here, you collaborated with my favorite burger spot in the city, Cabanos Cheeseburgers, on the Wit Stack. It was your own hamburger that you could get there. It's not a super well-known place. There is a location not too far from us. So if they're listening and they want to send some lunch, You go ahead. But Whit, how did that come about? And what went into designing what a Whit Merrifield burger is like?
Yeah, so we actually, for the first episode, brought some in, and Lindsay never had it. So shame
on her.
Pretty
good, right?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it came about just my agent was always looking for opportunities in the different cities that I played in. In Kansas City, I had my own beer, and we had a collaboration with a brewery in Kansas City. And so when we got to Toronto, this opportunity came about. Don't know how, but they found a partnership with Cabanos. I shouldn't know how to say it, but I think I say both always.
Depends on where you're from, I'd say.
Yeah.
You're good. So, with
yeah. So we ended up having a partnership, and they asked me, "What do you like in food or in a burger?" And I'm a huge buffalo sauce fan. Like, I love anything with buffalo sauce. That's right up my alley. So I told them that, and they said, "Great, let's do it. Let's have a burger with some buffalo, some jalapeno, and that's just couldn't be more perfect for me." So that was my burger, and if nobody liked it, it was my burger, so I didn't really care. I wanted to eat it. Well, so that was what we did.
I liked it, and like I said, it's my favorite spot in the city. They catered my Royal Rumble party a couple years ago as well. They're the best.
All the food is so good.
Yeah, it's great. Whit, terrific burger, terrific first episode of the podcast. Thanks so much for doing this with us, man. Looking forward to hearing more.
Thank you, guys, except for Lindsay. You did.
Bye, bestie. Thanks for fixing
How come you're
face?
Wearing headphones? You can't hear?
They're wearing smaller headphones, and I guess I had to listen to you today, so that's why I'm wearing it. Yeah. You should be happy I'm wearing these. I heard you talk about how great I am.
Whatever. All right. Bye, see y'all later. Yeah, man.
Whit Merrifield, 9-year Major League Baseball veteran, 3-time All-Star, and former Toronto Blue Jay, and co-host of The Sixth Inning Stretch, which the first episode is now out on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Lindsay, now that he's not on the line, do you just want to like take some shots at him on the way out the door or what?
He really needs to shower more often. My gosh. When he walked in the room, like, whoo, no kidding. I hope he's not listening. He's so sarcastic.
Listening. He would have hung up on
actually,
Zoom immediately.
Yeah, if he knows how to, he just would take the laptop and put it in another room. He's actually really nice and he's funny. Yeah. And so I'm hoping, I think that really comes across in the podcast. But now that people know that we're both very sarcastic, mm-hmm. and please just go even watch on YouTube the first 10 minutes because he is on a Japanese game show and he is shirtless and it's hilarious.
Wow. Yeah,
I need will. Here's one topic, not to produce your show for you, give you stuff. He was a big, and we've talked about this on the show and I talked to Tyler Heineman about it the other day. He was a big change his walk-up music feeling good. And like when he was here, I think he came out to Still Fly by the Big Timers, which is a great choice. But anyway, in looking up his old songs, I can't remember if it was when he was in Atlanta or Philadelphia, but he changed his song to Mr. Brightside at one point and referred to the Killers as emo. And I need you to explain to him, you know, there's a difference there and get into that a little bit.
Any reason to absolutely razz him? I'm in. You got this.
Yes, thank you.
We'll try for episode 2.
Yeah, looking forward to that. But you have a big guest for episode 2 who you won't reveal. All right, speaking of big guests, we're going to take a break. After that, we're going to play an interview I did yesterday with Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Really great chat, talking about Dave Parker, the Cobra, rest in peace there, and as Canada's connections to the history of the Negro Leagues as well. Really great chat. We'll also talk to Levi Weaver of The Athletic. We'll get you set for Game 3 of Blue Jays-Yankees, Will Warren against Jose Berríos. Lindsay, thank you so much, and congrats on the launch of Sixth Inning Stretch.
Thank you. Please listen.
Come back after this. The Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz only. Bye, Lindsay.
Bye.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Yesterday afternoon, Bob Kendrick took some time out of his busy schedule. So we went down to Kansas City and we chatted with the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, fresh off of a fun weekend between the Royals and Dodgers down in Kansas City, where a bunch of the Dodgers broadcasters and players went to the museum. Bob Kendrick was a part of those broadcasts. The baseball world lost Dave Parker, the Cobra, last week. If you are familiar with the famous shirt, if you hear any noise, that's just me and the boys bopping. That is Dave Parker. that is based on a cool song by Parliament that I wanted to play on the way in, but it is not radio appropriate. And yeah, Dave Parker finished his career with the Blue Jays. I didn't ask Bob about this, but a fascinating part of him as well is he was only the second player in baseball history and the first black player to get a salary that was $1 million or higher. And he went through so much, in addition to being like one of the coolest players ever, multi-time all-star, multi-time world champion and things like that, the disdain he got from fans for being that highly paid. And obviously there is a, look, people don't like how highly paid baseball players are in general, but in the 70s and 80s, if you are that highly paid and you are a flashy black athlete, you can understand that some of that reaction was not based on the dollar per wins above replacement at the time. Absolutely. So we talk a little Dave Parker. We talk about Canada's connection to the museum. We talk a little Geddy Lee as well. This is that interview with Bob Kendrick. Bob, thanks so much for joining us once again here. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I am doing well. You know, running around trying to keep a museum healthy and strong, but we're having a great summer. And despite the fact that I'm on the disabled list, with knee injury that I had to have knee surgery for, still out here kicking around though.
Sorry to hear about the knee surgery. It's obviously not slowing you down. I saw you pop up on the Dodgers broadcast on the weekend. How was that? That must have been a blast.
Well, anytime the Dodgers are in town, and I think in any city, is always big. The star power that they generate is so special, but the connectivity between the two cities, particularly as we look at the history of the game, Kansas City and Brooklyn specifically, before they moved out to LA, that connection is so strong because it's linked by Jackie Robinson, who began his illustrious professional baseball career right here in Kansas City for the great Kansas City Monarchs in 1945, before he became the chosen one to break Major League Baseball's then six-decade-long self-imposed color barrier. And so it was very special to have our salute to the Negro Leagues game with the Dodgers in town, and the Dodgers wore the Brooklyn Dodgers cap of one of the years that Jackie was there. The Royals wore the 1945 Monarchs cap the year that Jackie was there. So it was Jackie versus Jackie.
That's great. That sounds like a lot of fun. Of course, a little stop in there for Montreal for Jackie as well. A little Canadian
Absolutely.
Stop. So you got to, I saw you join both the English language and the Spanish language broadcast for the Dodgers for that one. The Spanish language one being with Jose Mota. And I'm curious as to, in your experience, there is obviously a connection between the history of the Negro Leagues and the history of players from Spanish speaking countries. Can you tell me a little bit about that connection?
It's little known, but very profound. Negro Leagues players were oftentimes, Blake, the first Americans to play in many Spanish-speaking countries. And when we went to those countries, man, we're treated like heroes. So now we're going to stay in the finest hotels that those countries had to offer, eat in the finest restaurants that those countries had to offer, and then you'd come back home and you'd be treated like a second-class citizen. So as a result, a lot of Negro League players would call those Spanish-speaking countries home for one simple reason. In those countries, they weren't black baseball players. They were just baseball players. But here in the U.S., the Afro-Latino athlete in particular couldn't play in the major leagues either, so they found sanctuary playing in the Negro Leagues. So when Jackie breaks the color barrier, he doesn't do it for just American-born blacks. He does it for every player of color who now enjoys our great sport. And so there is a bond that is kind of created through, as we like to say, baseball.
That's great. And how was your Spanish on the broadcast?
It was awful. Hell, I haven't mastered English yet, and my Spanish is even worse.
That's great. So, yeah, that was a part of the Royals doing their annual Salute to the Negro Leagues game on the weekend. That's obviously a specific weekend, but how often when teams are visiting the Royals do you get players or broadcasters and things like that trying to connect with you, trying to come to the museum? I saw Steven Nelson and some others came through the museum as well. Is that a pretty regular thing when the Royals host teams?
It has become a regular thing. And what I find for me so heartwarming is that early on, and when the museum was in its infancy, it was me reaching out to the clubs, trying to convince them to come and experience this museum. We've seen that kind of change dramatically to the point where they're now calling me, wanting to come to the museum. And that is so gratifying. And it also means that the word is spreading amongst themselves, their peers. You know, when Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, two of the biggest names in our game, when they call and say they want to come and visit the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and then you see a picture of them hanging out with us here, then I think everybody else says, you know what? Maybe when I get to Kansas City, I need to call old Bob and make sure that I go check out this Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And as I've oftentimes said, it never gets old for me. Anytime that we have the young athletes come and experience this museum, or those who make their living in this game or any sports discipline, it is always extra special for me to share these stories and relate this history back to them.
That's great. Yeah, I'm sure it's a good marketing thing, too, when it pops up on social media and people see those guys. But yeah, so important to pass on that knowledge and that history of the game to players and people like me who may not otherwise know it. Bob, want to ask you about something sad that happened this past week as well. The Cobra, Dave Parker, passed away. One of the coolest to ever do it. The photos live in infamy. A guy who ended his career with the Blue Jays, actually. Other than, you know, the sadness at hearing that news, what can you tell us about how you remember the legacy of Dave Parker?
The swagger, which was one of the reasons why in 2019, we inducted Dave into what we call the Hall of Game. And the Hall of Game annually honors former Major League players who played the game the way they played it in the Negro Leagues. So you played it with passion, you played it with high skill, but you also played it with a little swag. Yeah, you had to have that if you were going to play in the Negro Leagues, and the Cobra had it. You know, he had the great nickname. You know, he's 6'3", 6'4", ran like a gazelle, had just a cannon for an arm, but the presence. He had a presence. It didn't matter whether he was in the batter's box or out in the outfield. You know, it was almost like, okay, you gonna run on me? Yeah, okay, go right ahead. and that was so special. And, you know, he was ill when he came here in 2019, suffering, I believe, from Parkinson's. But when the minute he walked into this museum and we started talking baseball and we started telling baseball stories, you could see what it did for him. And I am so proud that we had that opportunity to honor him and that he could be there for that very well-deserved recognition. Like all of us, I'm a baseball fan, and I am tremendously saddened by his loss and the fact that it essentially happens 30 days before he was about to cross over into baseball immortality. But he knew he was going in. And it is so very reminiscent for me of a player in the Negro Leagues by the name of Leon Day. Leon Day was a star player in the Negro Leagues, one of the greatest pitchers to ever play this game, but he was also one of the great two-way players in this game's history. Leon Day was the last Negro Leaguer to still be alive to learn that he was going into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He was in a Baltimore hospital when he got the news. And 6 days later, he passed away. But again, at least he knew he was going into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And when the Cobra passed, it just conjured up memories of the great Leon Day on how he knew he was going in, but did not live long enough to be able to get to Cooperstown and deliver the speech for himself. But his legacy, his spirit, absolutely plays on here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
It's an interesting reminder, too. Obviously, it's the classic baseball era committee who decided to put Parker in. He didn't get in through the traditional means, but a nudge to that committee maybe to induct players in while they still have a chance to appreciate it, and we still have a chance to appreciate them. Obviously, like you said, Dave found out the news at least first. So that's a positive. You mentioned the Hall of Game Award. That's for anyone who doesn't know. So it's such a cool list of players who've been in there. And there are a lot of former Blue Jays on there. Ricky Henderson was one of the first ones. Dave Winfield, Dave Stewart and Fred McGriff went in the same class as Dave Parker. So a lot of Canadian ties there, a lot of Blue Jays and Expos ties with that award as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In a previous life, we recognized the great Cito Gaston with the Jackie Robinson Lifetime Achievement Award. We just opened up a brand new exhibit called Leaders and Innovators that celebrates the African-American managers of the Negro Leagues, and it transitions all the way into Major League Baseball. So Cito is highlighted in this exhibit. This year, for baseball fans who might not know, marks the 50th anniversary of Frank Robinson becoming the first African-American manager, full-time African-American manager in Major League Baseball history. And we thought that it would be appropriate for us to go back and do a retrospective look at the great managers of the Negro Leagues and the great executives, because, Blake, they didn't get an opportunity to transition into those roles in Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball looked at the field, and so players got a chance to transition, but those brilliant Black baseball minds, they didn't get a chance to manage at the major league level. And they would have been tremendous managers had the doors opened up and the opportunity had presented themselves. And so we wanted to go back and take a look at some of those great managers. And it takes it all the way up through modern day time. And so Dave Roberts was thrilled to know that he's also featured in this exhibition when I got a chance to catch up here with him on Sunday as well. And so, you know, we're excited to tell these kinds of stories along with the incredible innovations that came out of the Negro Leagues that are eye-opening for my guests when they learned that the batting helmet started in the Negro Leagues, the shin guards created in the Negro Leagues, and of course, the most prolific of them all, night baseball, originated in the Negro Leagues. Folks, they were playing night games in the Negro Leagues 5 years before they ever played a night game in the major leagues, although our history book is going to tell us that the first professional night baseball game, 1935, Crosley Field, Cincinnati, Ohio, Cincinnati Reds versus Philadelphia Phillies, the history book is wrong. First professional night baseball game, 1930, and it featured our very own Kansas City Monarchs. J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Monarchs, literally mortgaged everything he had to pioneer night baseball, portable generated light towers. So not only could they play a night game here in Kansas City, they could load them up on the truck and play a night game virtually anywhere. And all of that is highlighted in this exhibition. But I'm proud of my friend Cito Gaston and what he accomplished there in Toronto. Back-to-back World Series, man. You know, I tell people all the time, I don't care if Cito don't want a job, but you would think that his name would come up anytime a managerial role came available. And, you know, and maybe they called him and he just didn't want to do it anymore. But no, we're very proud of our friend Cito Gaston. We're very proud of our partnership with the Toronto Blue Jay, the Blue Jays, and all the Blue Jays that we've been able to honor through the years.
That's awesome. That's great. And for any Canadians who haven't made the trip, yeah, a lot of Canadian touch points. There are a lot of Canadian history overlapping with Black players in Major League Baseball, as well as the Negro Leagues. There's also, and I know you get asked about this one a lot, Bob, so I apologize, but there's also the 400-plus autographed balls that Geddy Lee, who is a very famous Canadian baseball fan, donated back in 2008. Signatures from Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and literally hundreds of others. What can you tell me about how you remember how that came about and getting to meet Geddy Lee when he donated those 400 balls back in 2008?
Yeah, always. I light up every time my Canadian friends come in to visit the museum. They see that case and they just say, is that the Geddy Lee? I'm like, yes, that is the Geddy Lee. And lead singer and bass guitarist of the legendary Hall of Fame Canadian rock group Rush. Rush was playing a concert here in Kansas City before the band officially retired several years ago. And Geddy had a good friend that lived here who says, I'm going to take you by to see the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And like most who come here, he fell in love with the museum. And after leaving, this collection of single-signed Negro League player autographed baseballs come up in an auction. And so he decided that he'd bid on them with the intent and hope of winning them so he could donate them back to us. We had no idea that this was going on. Well, he wins the bid. His office calls and says, Getty has a few baseballs he'd like to donate. Would you all like to have them? Well, naturally, I'm thinking, you know, three or four that he might have picked up somewhere.
Nah.
No. It turned out to be 200. He since donated an additional lot of 200, now giving us one of the largest collection of single-signed Negro League player autographed baseballs anywhere in the world. And it's all due to the benevolence of one Getty Lee, a white Canadian rocker. Yeah, who knew? I tell my guests, it just goes to show that this story has no boundaries. It has no limitations. It touches virtually everyone who encounters it. And as you mentioned, there were Hall of Famers in those cases. There are guys who were cup of coffee guys in the Negro Leagues, but they're all important to us. And 99.9% of the names on display in those cases, they're all dead. We couldn't have gotten their signatures even if we wanted them. And then the novelty name that jumps out, the legendary country western singer, Charlie Pride. A lot of people did not know that the great Charlie Pride played in the Negro Leagues. He actually was a really good pitcher in the Negro Leagues who made his way into the New York Yankees organization before he hurt his arm. It was after he hurt his arm that he then fell back on a pioneering country western music career some 72 million albums sold later. We should all have a fallback career like Charlie Pride.
Yeah, I don't know what mine is. Maybe it's talking about music. It's certainly not performing music. I'm a little surprised now that Getty didn't keep that one because of the music tie-in and everything, you know? That would have been fun. That's such a cool story. And Getty Lee, if you're listening, come on the show and tell us about it as well. Bob, before I let you go here, look, we've talked a little bit about the overlap between the Negro Leagues and Canada. For anyone who doesn't know, and I know you spoke with the Blue Jays about this in 2024 for a YouTube video, how big a part Canada played when the Negro Leagues were a barnstorming operation and the ability to come to Canada and play against other professional teams, how big a part did Canada play in kind of that era of baseball?
And not only did it play a great role during that era of barnstorming when Negro Leagues baseball was at its height, barnstorming post-integration, it also played a great role because that older Negro Leagues player that the major leagues didn't want would ultimately end up going to Canada or back to Latin America to continue their career. And they found much more favorable playing conditions in Canada than they did here at home. And that's not to say that there wasn't some racism, but it wasn't nearly as vile as it had been in a Jim Crow South here in the U.S. Jackie Robinson and Mrs. Robinson, Rachel Robinson, absolutely loved their time in Montreal. They spoke so highly of how they were treated playing there. The great Wilmer Fields was a superstar there. Willie Wells, who's in the Hall of Fame, nicknamed him El Diablo, the devil, because he could dig it out of the dirt. One of the greatest shortstops, not in black baseball history, but in baseball history. He played and managed there in Canada. And of course, your very own Ferguson Jenkins' father played black baseball there in Canada. And so they found far favorable conditions there playing in Canada than they did at home. And so Canada plays a tremendous role in our story as we tell it here at the museum and through some of the traveling exhibitions that we've created as well. And so we always like to tout those kinds of connections because it also speaks to the global impact that the Negro Leagues had. We talked about them taking baseball into those Spanish-speaking countries and now going into Canada to play. It was a touring team of Negro Leaguers, Blake, that introduced the American brand of professional baseball to the Japanese, going all the way back to 1927. Man, that's 7 years before Babe Ruth and his All-Americans would go to Japan. And of course, they've been oftentimes credited with having taken the American brand of professional baseball to the Japanese, but it's not true. It was a team called the Philadelphia Royal Giants, who would go to Japan in 1927, play a 24-game exhibition series. They go 23-0-1 on the tour. The tour was so successful that 7 years later, Ruth and his All-Americans would make that trek. And I always preface that with my visitors because, as you very well know, when we look at our game today from a global perspective, there are so many ethnicities that make up a Major League roster on any given day. Folks, at the heart of it were the Negro Leagues. They helped make the game the global game that it is. They just simply were never given credit for it. And quite frankly, y'all, the Negro Leagues didn't care what color you were. All they cared was, can you play? And if you can play, you can play.
It's great. And there's that influence. And then, like you said, to take it back to the Cobra, Dave Parker, there's that coolness and flair influence that continues on. And I would love to see it in even more players. Bob, you're such an amazing storyteller. This was so great. Thanks so much for coming on. And yeah, one of these days I'm getting down there and we'll chop it up a little more.
Man, I can't wait to welcome you to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Bob Kendrick, what a gem.
Yeah, that was incredible. So educational, so well told. Getty Lee, man. That was Charlie Pride. Awesome part of it.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done being a pro baseball player. Why don't I just be a country musician afterward? Fun stuff.
Very fun stuff. I'll take this off the air, but I'm very curious to hear if you have given it any more thoughts to your fallback career if you were not doing this.
No, I already don't have a real job. There's no fallback to that. Unfortunately, it would be working, a real job.
Yeah, that's the fallback.
Yeah. All right, let's not do that. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Levi Weaver of The Athletic. The Texas Rangers are interesting as we size up who might be buyers, who might be sellers. Ben Nicholson-Smith has a great piece up at sportsnet.ca today looking at what the price tags were last deadline for some of the stuff that the Blue Jays may be shopping with. We'll kick that around with Levi Weaver as well. We'll get you set for Will Warren against Jose Berríos as the Jays look to take a series and maybe keep the possibility open of a sweep against the Yankees tonight down at Rogers Center. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy, Julia Kreutz with you. The Jays will look to take a third off the Yankees tonight, while elsewhere in baseball, Clayton Kershaw will look to get strikeout number 3,000. He's at 2,997 heading into tonight. In the latest edition of the Windup newsletter, Levi Weaver broke it down of The Athletic. He joins us now. Levi, what's up, man? How are you?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, man. Good. I mentioned the Kershaw thing off the top, but I got to ask you about Jack Leiter first. You wrote a
way
terrific,
more impressive.
Yeah, way more impressive. Even if it was a strikeout, you wrote about it the other day. For anyone who didn't see it, in the 11th inning of a game in which the benches had both been used up, the DH had been forfeited, Jack Leiter was called on as a pinch hitter. Man, can you walk us through a little bit of this? And yeah, you dusting off the reporting chops to write it up.
Yeah. I went to the game last night because I was just curious. So we talked to Bruce Bochy about it, and he said, first of all, Hobie Milner, who was the reliever, he played outfield in high school. He probably would have maybe been a better option, but he had just pitched 3 out of 4 days. He'd had a rough top of the 11th inning. He gave up 4 runs. So Bochy was like, that would be piling on. Jacob deGrom used to play in the National League, but Bochy says he considered it. He rolled his eyes. He's like, yeah, that's just what I need. Jacob deGrom to go injure his oblique while he's swinging a bat. So he said, he looked down the end of the bench and he said, Jack Leiter looked the most hitterish, which I thought was funny. He goes and talks to Leiter and, he goes, hey, who's a better hitter between you and Kumar Rocker? And Leiter kind of smiles and he goes, obviously it's me. And I asked him yesterday, like, is that true? And like, there's no way to put in print, and I'm not sure I'm going to do a good job of imitating Jack Leiter's face, but I feel like this is a more effective way to relay his response. He goes, yeah, definitely. It was me.
Okay.
So He goes back and he immediately, like, he's like, I haven't taken an at bat in 6 years since the high school championship game in 2019. So he's like, he's trying on helmets and they all fit weird and they hurt his head. So he borrows Kyle Higashioka's, which is way too big. People are, have just been roasting him online ever since. he's taking it in stride. So he goes and starts taking soft toss and he's like, it's like rolling over soft toss pitches. It's not going well. Finally starts to make some contact, goes into the, they've got one of the traject machines that it's a video of the pitcher and it throws you the pitcher stuff. It's actually a really cool machine. And he's like whiffing everything, like cannot make contact. Like finally starts to make enough contact. Meanwhile, Bochy is in the dugout and he keeps looking over. He's like, where's Leiter? And everybody goes, he's still hitting. He's like getting loosened up. He comes out, Bochy goes, listen, take three pitches. Like, you don't hurt yourself, don't swing. And Leiter's like, I literally just went back into the batting cages. Like, come on, let me, I'll take two. Let me just swing at one. And Bochy goes, all right, you can swing at one. And then, of course, Andrew Kittredge throws in two fastballs right down the middle. Leiter has to take them. Finally, he's got his green light. Here he goes. And he sees Kittredge wave off, like shake off the catcher. And he's like, I knew a breaking ball was coming, but I've literally never seen a big league breaking ball. So he swings and misses. The pitch is like a foot outside. It was a terrible at bat, but it's such a funny story. Because in baseball, you know, like sometimes these things happen. Sometimes the one catcher gets hurt, the other one gets pinch run for, so both DHs are out. Now it's a weird game. And sure, yeah, Jack Leiter, let's take him at bat. And that's big league, major league, best league in the world baseball.
Yeah, you look at the box score for that game and the lineups and the lineup changes, both of them just look like grocery lists, right? It's just so much happened in this game. And yeah. I think you described it as chaos personified. But yeah, it was a game where both DH spots were relinquished at one point. It just doesn't happen very often, right, Levi? But this is still kind of why we do this. Those chaotic moments, those messy moments, they make for good stories as well.
Yeah, and the stage for this was actually set in the three nights prior because the Rangers were coming off three straight extra innings games. Bruce Bochy's trying to save his bullpen from a fourth. So in the ninth inning, Kyle Higashioka gets a single. It's a tie game. Bochy knows that if he runs for him, he's going to have to forfeit the DH, but he's like, we have to win this in nine innings. So he puts in a pinch runner. Ezekiel Duran steals second base, steals third base. It looks like it's going well. The Rangers can't get him in, and it goes to extras anyway, and now they have no DH.
Brutal. And then they lose the game.
And then they lose.
On top of everything else. Man, there's
and
so...
Yeah, 10-6.
There's a lot cool in here. I'm curious, do you, like... The universal DH is good. It is better for offense at a time when we really need offense and things like that. Do you kind of miss this part of it, though? Like when there was still a pitcher and there's double switches and some absurd strategy stuff that we would get to break down and nitpick a little bit. Like, obviously, the juice is not worth the squeeze in terms of I'd rather just have the extra 30 home runs or whatever for each team. But right. I personally, reading your piece on it, like, I miss this kind of nonsense once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you said. Like, the juice is not worth the squeeze. But sure, yes, the double switch was fun. Once in a while, you get the, you know, the homer from a pitcher and everybody loses their mind and it's great. But, like, it's a better game when the pitchers aren't hitting. And so I'm glad that when we did have that pitchers hitting bit in the National League and, you know, in 1972, everybody had the pitchers hitting. We at least got cool, interesting, weird stuff like that. But, but yeah, it pains me to say it because I am sort of like a chaos goblin when it comes to what I root for in baseball. Like, I love moments like this. This is what I want to happen. But if it happens all the time, it's not that fun. And I can give you like evidence of this. Is it cool to see position players pitching anymore?
No, it's happening way too often. Yeah. The Blue Jays have it like once a week where someone is pitching to them or they're pitching. Yeah, it's... I get it, but it's
right.
A little
it used
overdone.
To be like a twice a year thing, and it was so fun, right?
Yeah, and Jonah Bride like, pitched yeah, four okay, times sure. in a short window between DFAs. I think it was he got picked up by the Twins, and they were just like, you know what, you're our 13th batter, and then also you're going to pitch all the time. Odd.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not fun anymore. So yeah, you know, chaos has to be rare to be special.
Yeah, that's very well put. Okay. Last one for you on the lighter story. The idea of him going in there and hitting against Kittredge on the traject machine. So, again, for anyone who doesn't know, the traject machine is like a pitching machine, but it can model the spin and release point and things like that for different pitchers. And then they overlay a video of that pitcher. So it's as close to like a virtual reality kind of thing, but with a real ball coming at you. The idea struck me that some pitchers are probably going in there and facing themselves. And I know Jack Leiter joked about it, but like, wouldn't you be so tempted if you're a pitcher to try to hit off yourself and see if Jack Leiter can hit Jack Leiter?
Yeah, like I had never really considered it before. And then he said that last night and I was like, oh man, like if I was a pitching coach, now I would not even give them a bat to go in there with. I don't want my pitchers hurting themselves, right? Like do not be tempted to swing because I know you would be. But stand in there and watch your stuff and see how hard it is to hit. Like, I feel like pitchers' confidence would be boosted unless they watched it and they're like, yeah, I need to change a few things because that's easy. No, I think it would be like a good tool for pitchers to stand in and see themselves.
I feel like the only pitcher who would do that, the like that's easy, is like the legendary stories of Zach Greinke telling his NL teammates,
it's
like, why don't you just go hit a home run like I hit a home run?
Oh, man.
Exactly.
Maybe that's more of an off-season project, right? Where if a guy has access to a traject machine, because obviously starting pitchers and relief pitchers as well, their routine is so so specific throughout the season that this may be more of a winter project. But listen, in the same way that they probably pick up MLB The Show and play as themselves, this is kind of just another element to that.
Yes, yeah, like a very advanced version of that, yeah.
Obviously, we wanted to talk to you about the Rangers as well. That game and chaos notwithstanding, Levi, it seems like, well, losing records still, the bats maybe start to pick up a little bit. We saw Marcus Semien hitting a walk-off hit, right, in one of those extra inning games there. Still not able to build off of those improvements. What do you make of where the Rangers are right now, considering that the trade deadline is approaching pretty fast here?
It is. Toronto is actually probably a team that should be watching the Rangers pretty closely because they could use a starting pitcher. And the Rangers, that's the one thing they've done really well this year. So they have some starting pitchers that could be available. I keep watching this team going, they should be better than this. The offense should be better than this. But then you look up and you've got like Michael Hellman and Billy McKinney are on the roster. And no offense to those guys, they're big leaguers, but like those are not guys that you really probably want in the starting lineup if you're trying to rescue your season. It just does not seem to be coming together. And like there have been flashes of it. Corey Seager was hurt for quite a while. He seems to be fully, fully back now. But is it too late? You know, like the Jake Berger has not been what the Rangers hoped when they traded away Nate Lowe and brought in Berger. Semien had a wretched start to the season. He seems to have finally kind of put it together. Like, so some of the elements are there and you keep thinking like, this should be a lineup that scores runs. Meanwhile, the pitchers are out there like shoving. They're like, I think like the second best ERA in the league. It's weird to watch a Rangers team do that because for so long they were just like an all-hit, no-pitch team. It's a weird fever dream to watch this squad struggle, like pitch really well and struggle. So, you might have a – if you need a scouting report later on after the deadline, if one of the Rangers end up north of the border, let me know.
Yeah, well, it's an odd one too, right? Because like – I mean, first of all, they're only 2.5 games out, and they've got a couple teams to jump. But like the Mariners, you're in the same division; you'll have some opportunity there.
Right.
I think I love watching the Angels. I think they're probably going to come back down to earth a little bit at some point. It's not that far fetched that they could play their way back into it. But you don't have 3 months; you have kind of this month to make your case. The other thing that gets really interesting about it is the Rangers' top arms have term left and big money. So if you're the Rangers and let's say you lose 15 of the next 20 and you're really out of it by the trade deadline, Jacob DeGrom with two more years at 75 million total plus a $20 million option and he's 37, like Jacob DeGrom by far the best pitcher who could possibly hit the market. What does that look like when you factor in the age and the money? A guy like Nate Eovaldi, who they just signed and has a couple more years left, they're just each of their individual pitchers that would be available is a tough guy to figure, you know, would the Rangers pull the plug on, with multiple years left on pitcher X? It's just a hard team to figure in a lot of ways, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on their belief in the ability to sort of, you know, restock on the offense for next year. Because, as you said, these guys are older, but it's not like DeGrom's always a health risk. But it's not like the difference between 37 and 38 is exponential. Eovaldi seems to be aging pretty well, I say, as he's coming off his second start off the injured list. I think Tyler Mahlin might be an interesting one, though. If he comes back healthy, he had a really strong first half. He is a guy that is, I think he's a free agent after this year.
Yeah.
So he's somebody that could probably be had if he comes back healthy and looks good in his, you know, first start or two back. And then, you know, the question is, it's exactly what you said. Like, do they believe that those two guys, I mean, it comes back to DeGrom and Eovaldi. Do they believe that those two guys are centerpieces for next year's rotation? Or do they think, let's get out while the getting's good, save some money, and sign somebody else? Could I interest you in a Patrick Corbin?
That's a little further down. So we were kicking this around with Eno the other day of, like, the name. Look, they'll need depth anyway. Max Scherzer's not a lock to keep pitching. Eric Lauer's not a lock to keep pitching like this. But where the needle really starts to move is, are you bumping one of Berríos, Gausman, or Bassett out of the wild card series? That's kind of the level where I'm like, well, Patrick Corbin doesn't do that. It'd be nice to have that as insurance on Eric Lauer and Max Scherzer, but it's not moving the needle a ton in terms of, like, prospect capital, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it is very much a matter of raising the ceiling or raising the floor here, and
floor is important.
Like the Blue Jays to be focused on raising the ceiling, but we'll see.
Levi, this is, so the Rangers are in this spot, and the Rangers are kind of a unique case in that they are so heavily leveraged financially. A lot of these guys have term. They recently won a World Series. But then we look around baseball. We look around some of the work you and your colleagues are doing at The Athletic to set the deadline up here 4 weeks away. And you use this great Descartes quote, indecision is also a species of fear, holding the soul in suspense. What do you make of kind of in this new wild card era, and I think it's the fifth year of it, like, the proof is there. We don't have sellers at this point in the year. And I know fan bases get eager, get anxious. Why aren't more teams doing the Devers trade, the Luis Arraez trade from the other year? And the answer is that, like, nobody other than, like, Miami and the White Sox right now are probably firmly listening on guys. What do you make of that environment kind of being, that's what it is now early in July, year over year?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you know, if you want to use the Rangers as an example, they have a losing record, and guess what? They're 2.5 games out of a wild card spot.
Yeah.
So, do you want to sell the idea to your fans that, like, well, you know, honestly, we don't really care. Like, let's punt this down the road. Let's do it for next year. That's a hard sell for fans, and you need to sell tickets, and it's, you know, important to have them understand. It's also hard to sell to the players on the roster that are going to be around for the next 3 to 5 years. Like, oh, do you remember 2025 when we were 2.5 games out of a wild card spot and you guys traded away our best pitcher? Like, that sucked. We saw that play out in Milwaukee a few years ago when they traded Josh Hader. So, yeah, you're right. It's harder to fully, like, bite the bullet and go, yeah, we're going to sell this year. Sure, if you're the Pirates, great. Whoever wants Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, come get him. But unless you're one of those teams. And you know what makes this even weirder? The Colorado Rockies are one of those teams, and who knows what their sale, like, trade philosophy is. Like, I keep going back to the fact that they extended Daniel Bard instead of trading him a couple of years ago. What are they doing? So it's like you've got one seller that should be a seller, and even they are like, nah, probably not. The Angels a couple of years ago should have been sellers, and they're like, well, it's our last year with Ohtani because we're not going to offer him a good contract, so why don't we trade for Lucas Giolito and, like, muddy the pool of buyers? Like, so it's not just the teams that, like, can justifiably go, it's kind of here, we're neither here nor there, let's take the optimistic route. You've also got teams that are just doing stupid things, and it makes it where if you are a seller, like, here is, when we talk about parity in a sport, here's what should happen. The fact that there aren't that many sellers should run up the price on pitchers or position players who are available. It should be a way for bad teams to kickstart that rebuild faster. The problem is that I think a lot of the bad teams are bad for a reason. Their front offices are not really making these smart moves to begin with. And not every team is bad because their front office is stupid. I think the Orioles have still a very good front office. And this has just been like they made a bad decision to not invest in pitching over the offseason. But yeah, it should be a way to increase parity throughout the league without having to resort to, the owner's dream of a salary cap.
I will tell you a team that is for sure going to be a buyer at the deadline, and that is the Los Angeles Dodgers. Clayton Kershaw, obviously back on the mound today. Levi, going for 3,000 strikeouts. He's a three away now. You wrote about him a little bit today, earlier this morning. And, yeah, just wondering what you make of this pursuit. I know that you linked even to the Andy McCullough biography on Clayton Kershaw that came out last year, Last of His Kind.
Great read, by the way.
Yeah, what do you make of that pursuit right now and what it represents for starting pitching?
And just one clarification. I did not write that earlier this morning. As you guys can tell from my face, I just woke up. I write these
things. That was published
before.
Earlier this morning.
Kershaw, I think it's a very good title for McCullough's book, The Last of His Kind, because, he'll be just the 20th pitcher in big league history to hit 3,000 strikeouts. It's a big deal. The next closest is Chris Sale, who has like 2,500 and something. He's on the injured list with a fractured ribcage. He could get there. But I looked at all of these pitchers who made it to 3,000 strikeouts, and I took out Scherzer and Verlander because they're still putting their stats together. But like these guys averaged about 21 years in the league, and they averaged, even at the end of their careers, like this is the peak and the beginning and the end, right? Averaged 212 innings per season. Yes, there are more strikeouts now than there were in Bob Gibson's days, right? Like batters used to be ashamed to strike out. There aren't that many Tony Gwynns there weren't then either, but like there are more strikeouts now, right? The strikeout per nine rate is growing, but nobody pitched 212 innings last year. And that was the average for those guys. The league leader last year was 208 innings. So it's a different game. That's what I said this morning. Like, yeah, it's a different game, more strikeouts. It's also a different game. Pitchers are not pitching that workload anymore. And even though, like, that's not even to mention, to lose a year to Tommy John is kind of de rigueur at this point. Like, it's just probably going to happen. So you lose that year. You've got pitchers or managers who are trying to prevent you from losing that year that are like, listen, I know you've only thrown 80 pitches in six innings. We're good. We got three guys out there that are going to come in and throw the ball 104 miles an hour. So you did your job. The pitchers are not throwing, and probably it comes back down to the question that everything comes back down to with pitching. Guys are going max effort now.
Yeah.
They're blowing their arms out. This is the problem that everybody has with injuries in the sport. But it also means that they're not going to throw 130, 140 pitches because you can't throw max effort for that many pitches in one game.
No, it's almost impossible, and yeah, keeping guys healthy is just it's a decaying stat. Max Scherzer's a fun one to think on because he's with the Blue Jays, and he's done it in 2,891 innings. Only Pedro Martinez has thrown 3,000 strikeouts in fewer innings than Max Scherzer, although Clayton Kershaw would top both of those guys if he does it tonight for fewest innings to get to 3,000. Levi, thanks so much for doing this, man. Keep up all the great work. Really appreciate it.
Of course. I can't wait till you guys move to afternoons so I can look like so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
You look
like,
great. I wouldn't have noticed if you didn't say anything.
Yep. Well, thank you. Thank you. No, it's always good to talk to you guys.
Levi Weaver of The Athletic. It's the wind-up newsletter in your inbox every morning. Yeah, we'll see if Kershaw joins the 3,000 strikeout club tonight. It's pretty crazy. Like when you contextualize that kind of stuff and then you look at Jose Berríos, for example, who has never missed the start, who has been, by ERA, with the exception of 2022, the most consistent pitcher in baseball for the last decade. He came in the league in 2016, hasn't hit the IL, 4.02 ERA, ERA right around 3.85 most years, and then there's that one outlier year. And then you look at his career stats, and he's just crossed 1,500 innings. So he's done this for a decade, and he's halfway to 3,000 innings, which was like a big milestone for a long time that I don't know that anyone's getting to. He's at 1,432 strikeouts. He would have to not only last as long as he's already lasted as the most consistent and durable pitcher in baseball, but also up the strikeout rate in the next 10 years of his career to get there. It's pretty remarkable just how difficult that has become. A lot of fun to think about and contextualize, though. It'll be a lot of fun to watch Jose Berríos try to mow down the Yankees tonight. They've faced him a ton over the years. Aaron Judge has had some success, but just 2-for-8 in the last 2 years and has not gotten a hit off a non-sinker. So maybe Berríos goes away from the sinker in that matchup. Will Warren has never faced the Blue Jays. Comes in with a 4.37 ERA and much better underlying numbers than that. He has a 1.96 ERA over his last four starts. Things are starting to come around for him. Really funky guy. First base side, big wide step to the right. Low arm angle. Good luck figuring it out the first time you see it. Hopefully tomorrow we're talking about the Jays going for a sweep. For today, thank you to Lindsay Dunn, Whit Merrifield, Bob Kendrick, and Levi Weaver. Thanks to Nick Blackmore, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it down. Hope you all have a wonderful Wednesday.
Have a wonderful Wednesday.